19 years later, after hypnosis, she remembers that she somehow had contributed to the success of whatever it was the UFO crew had been up to. In an apparent one-way transaction, they got from her what they needed, and she was left with a bloody shirt and a confused memory. The situation of abductees being made to feel special, loved, members of the Select, occasionally occurs in abduction cases. The reasons for their having been singled out are almost always vague, but the abductees feel gratified and less frightened, though not necessarily less confused. An interesting parallel presents itself in the accounts of former followers of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church. At the beginning of their recruitment, an overpowering sense of being needed and wanted is systematically instilled in them by Moony operatives. Lonely college students are visited in their dormitory rooms, fed milk and cookies, invited to love, drenched weekend retreats, and slowly won over before specific issues and ideology or dogma are even mentioned. This love technique is so thoroughly overwhelming that, when articles of religious belief are finally introduced, the subject feels like an ingrate to reject them. Bestowing importance and showering love upon the potential convert weakens his opposition and sets him up for whatever unusual demands are to be made of him. This potent method seems to have happened in a number of UFO abductions. For example, under hypnosis, David Oldham recounted the following dialogue. Standing terrified and unable to move before his abductor, he says, "He wants to hug me," says, "Why are you scared? I've never seen something like this. Someone loves you, very deeply, and they want to see you. Close your eyes, and be still." These soothing words are immediately followed by a painful operation of some kind. "What are you? What are you putting me in? What? It hurts. Oh, can't see, can't see, can't breathe." David is told by his captor to relax. "I'm relaxed. I'm relaxed. Help. Help." Dr. Claymore tries to calm him, and then, seconds later, hands. "In cramps, in cramps, in cramps. My arms, oh, my body is vibrating. I'm just standing here, I can't see. Something is above me, and it makes me vibrate." Again, after all the pain and fright caused by this new process, David is cajoled by soothing, and flattering, words. "Now," he says, "we are working with your mind. We know you have very strong mental abilities." It is difficult to avoid the impression that David is being loved and used. The bestowing of affection and importance upon a 16-year-old boy helps immensely in reducing his resistance to whatever complex and hurtful procedures are central to his abduction. The inference is the same that I made in Virginia's abduction. The reality is the physical operation and its attendant pain. The sense of happiness and love is an enforced illusion. It should be added that Virginia insists the good feelings of the celebratory party were just as real as the blood and tissue samples taken from her, so my reactions are frankly personal and speculative. The use of calming, even deliberately misleading words for administering a degree of unavoidable pain is a familiar method to tens of thousands of doctors and pediatricians. In fact, as I watched David lying agitated and tearful on Dr. Claymore's couch, a particular image sprang into my mind. It was that of a little boy being rolled out of the hospital recovery room, his semi-anesthetized mind aswirl with pain and the surgeon's half-remembered words of encouragement. This medical situation provides a helpful model for evaluating what actually may be taking place in UFO abductions. Consider the complexity of a not uncommon earthly event, surgery to remove a diseased appendix. At least three major aspects of the experience can be isolated. First, there is a series of what the patient experiences as physical acts. He lies in a particular hospital room. He is prepped for the operation, and perhaps then receives a tranquilizing injection. He is rolled down to the operating room, and there he receives a general anesthetic. Though he does not actually feel it, an incision in the abdomen is made, The appendix is located and removed, and the wound is closed. Eventually, the patient awakens in the recovery room, and usually then experiences some pain. But second, and opposed to these physical facts, there are psychic aspects to his experience. The patient is naturally uneasy when he enters the hospital. The tranquilizing drug renders his perceptions vague and softly passive. The general anesthetic may provide him with seconds of dreamlike near hallucination at each end of a period of unconsciousness. Recovery to full awareness is gradual and full of rambling, out of focus sensations. Afterwards, no one, least of all the patient, can absolutely sort out which perceptions are accurate, specific memories of his experience and which have been colored by the drugs and the general psychological context. A third aspect of this common medical procedure is the way a patient integrates this experience into his life, whether he dreams about it, more or less forgets about it, whether or not it lingers as a traumatic event, etc. Obviously, individual idiosyncrasies will provide a wide range of subsequent reactions. If we were to select at random 10 people who had undergone appendectomies, and then were to subject them one at a time to regressive hypnosis, we should expect a fairly wide range of response. Hospital procedures might differ. Pain thresholds vary, and the ages of the 10 might lead to different reactions. Yet beneath these variations in detail and emphasis, there would remain a unifying core of description. It would be clear that all 10 shared the same basic experience. And so it is, I believe, with Virginia Horton, Philip Osborne, Stephen Kilburn, and the others whose accounts we have been examining in these pages. Three simple descriptions quoted earlier nicely encapsulate the range of response to one particular operation: the apparent taking of blood and tissue from inside the nostril, the withdrawn and laconic Sandy Larson, "It was like somebody took the knife and made the inside of my nose sore," Betty Andreessen, "Frightened and vividly susceptible to pain. He's putting that thing in my nose. It's breaking through something. It's hurting." Virginia Horton, calmly comparing it to the earlier time when a similar sample was taken from her leg, "Since I remembered it happening the first time, I hardly even paid any attention to it." During her hypnotic recall, Virginia made many quick observations, remarks almost tossed away, which have their echoes in other UFO abduction cases. She described her captors as having a hard time explaining to me why it was so exciting, except that the older man, who had done the research, was really beside himself with excitement. Also under hypnosis, Betty Hill said of the tests she was undergoing, "I don't know what they're doing, but they seem to be so happy about whatever they're doing." Virginia recalled that, while she was in the woods, she heard her name being called in my head, "So they knew my name. They knew how to call me." After his abduction in 1975, Sergeant Charles Moody said that his captors knew who I was and called me by my proper name, Charles. They did not use my nickname, Chuck. It was like they could read my mind, and I believe they did because the elder or leader would speak sometimes before I would ask something. Barney Hill, trying to find the proper phrase, said, "He did not speak by word. I was told what to do by his thoughts making my thoughts understand." Sandy Larson 11 was asked to describe the telepathic communication she experienced, and she answered that it was like a thought between two people, when you know what the other person's gonna say. Virginia emerged from the Alsatian woods remembering only the excitement of her experience with the deer. She was annoyed by her family's insistence that she had been missing, because their hectoring questions interfered with her euphoric mood. "I remember thinking if they hadn't been hollering at me, I would still have been talking to the deer. It was as though I had walked out of the woods and claimed that I saw a unicorn." There was that sense of excitement and wonder. This euphoria at the end of a UFO abduction is commonly reported despite the initial terror. It seems to me to be an artificially induced emotion, perhaps some sort of powerful post-hypnotic suggestion. Despite the fear Barney and Betty Hill experienced when they were first taken, Barney described the denouement this way: "I see Betty coming down the road, and she gets into her car, And I am grinning at her and she's grinning back at me. And we both seem so elated and we are really happy. And I'm thinking it isn't too bad. How funny. I laugh and say, well, there it goes. And I'm happy. 12. If Virginia's memories seem weighted toward the euphoric and devoid of anything specifically frightening, the reader will remember that she still has not recalled the moment when, as a little girl, she first encountered the approaching gray, clad figures. Even her very earliest recollection, the sensation of being carried toward the UFO, is imperfectly remembered. In every hypnotically retrieved narrative I have witnessed so far, there are a few missing parts, as if there were either periods of actual unconsciousness or some moments which have been especially deeply repressed. Despite this omission, the long, detailed accounts of Virginia Horton's two abduction experiences both fold neatly into the overall pattern. The descriptions, Virginia's and others' Kahia, and buried within them all are subtle clues to the possible meaning of these disturbing encounters. On its spectacular surface, a UFO abduction appears to be an encounter in which extraterrestrials capture and examine human specimens in some kind of anthropological, biological quest for information. But the questions Virginia Horton, Betty Hill, and other abductees remember being asked are the kinds of questions for which answers are easily obtainable. How long people live, what they eat, and so forth, to acquire this kind of information. Along with basic anatomical data, a handful of human subjects should suffice. In fact, the typical abductee initially believes that he or she is one of the very few people ever to undergo such an experience. Yet so far, and despite all the obstacles I described earlier, roughly 500 individual abduction experiences have come to light. One, surely hundreds, perhaps thousands of other such abductions must still lie buried in the silence of enforced amnesia. Why have the UFO occupants taken so many, and why, apparently, do they attempt to conceal the nature and magnitude of their operations? Basic information gathering on the species simply cannot explain all these separate events. Two other related possibilities suggest themselves, however. Either the UFO crew members are taking something besides information, or they are leaving something behind with their captives. When Betty Andreessen underwent hypnosis to explore her 1967 abduction, some evidence surfaced suggesting that she had also had an earlier childhood abduction. More significantly, she recalled that, during her 1967 encounter, when the instrument was removed from her nostril, there was a tiny spherical object on its very tip. This tiny ball had spiny projections around its surface, and she was certain that it had not been there when the probe was first pressed up into her nose. Was this some kind of an implant that had been put in place in an earlier childhood abduction? We know, of course, that Virginia Horton had a lengthy encounter at the age of 6, and that during her second experience a probe of some sort was inserted in her nostril and caused some bleeding when it was removed. She remembers not paying much attention to it. Being somewhat squeamish myself, I also try not to pay too much attention when I receive an injection or have a blood test performed, so I can easily sympathize with her attitude. The possibility remains that there was, in her case, too, something on the end of the nasal probe when it came out that was not there earlier, and which Virginia did not happen to notice. Dr. James Harder, professor of engineering at the University of California at Berkeley, is a distinguished UFO investigator and director of research for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization APRO. In the course of his investigations across the United States, he has worked with over 100 people who, while under hypnosis, recalled abduction experiences. The majority of these, Harder believes, show evidence of having been abducted before, as children, often when they were 6 or 7 years old. Like Virginia, a number of them recall seeing the same captors both times. One inescapable inference to be drawn from this pattern is that a very long, term, in depth study is being made of a relatively large sample of humans, and that this study may involve mechanical implants of some sort. Perhaps Virginia Horton, Betty Andreessen, and others as children had tiny monitoring devices installed high in their nasal cavities, much as terrestrial ecologists and zoologists install implants to monitor wildlife. A neurosurgeon informed me that certain brain operations, tissue biopsies, for example, can be carried out by entering the brain from below, through this convenient channel. If such a long-term monitoring system is going on, it would help explain the decades of surreptitious UFO behavior and the absence of direct communication. Dr. Robert Jastrow once said something to the effect that any extraterrestrials who have the technology to travel from their planet to Earth must be vastly ahead of us scientifically and intellectually. Their behavior, then, would inevitably be somewhat incomprehensible. He added that if we understand everything they and here he meant any UFO occupants, are doing, then they are probably not extraterrestrial in origin. It's a neat, clean way to state our own anthropomorphic limitations. Our astronauts on the moon conducted a number of investigatory experiments across a wide scientific range. An advanced culture visiting Earth would probably also conduct many simultaneous investigations across an even wider scientific range, with the crucial difference that we could probably not understand all of them, either their purposes or their technology. Virginia Horton's account is thoroughly consonant with Jastrow's dictum. They were having a hard time explaining why their research was so exciting. It is irrelevant to raise the kind of objection that goes like this: if extraterrestrials are real 11, why here? Why do they bother with 6-year-old children when they can land publicly and talk to our presidents and our scientists? As if Ronald Reagan or Jimmy Carter, or, for that matter, Carl Sagan or Robert Jastrow, must inevitably be central to their concerns. Maybe yes, but equally conceivable, maybe no. Perhaps their kind of preliminary investigation requires monitoring a wide range of people over their entire lifetimes, an idea no less implausible than many others I have heard. To oppose the hypnotically retrieved abduction accounts solely because of one's personal notion of how real extraterrestrials should behave is unbounded arrogance. These hundreds of similar, highly specific recollections are the core of the problem. They represent data, which we must deal with, one way or another. There is another possible explanation for the apparently large number of individual abductions, one which does not necessarily involve either implants or a long-term study of the human species. What if the UFO occupants are taking something from their captives? Many people assume, again anthropomorphically, that if alien beings could travel across distances ranging upwards from 4 light years, the distance of the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, from Earth, then they must indeed be supermen. And the idea is therefore ludicrous that they might need anything we possess. Even more outrageous, they add, is the idea that extraterrestrials might be afraid of us, or vulnerable in any way. But why assume any of these things? We may indeed possess something, a natural resource, an element, a genetic structure, that an alien culture might desire to use, for example, as experimental raw material. The evidence for a particular kind of sample taking is very strong. In the introduction, I alluded to an encounter that took place in the Catskill Forest Preserve on November 8, 1975, and which Ted Blocher and I later investigated. Two young men on a camping trip were awakened by noises close to their tent. Fearing the possibility of a scavenging bear, they went outside, flashlights in hand, and noticed back in the woods what they thought at first was a large Airstream trailer. Realizing there was no road where this vehicle rested, they investigated further and found that it was, instead, some sort of peculiar, oval, semi-ominous craft. Their flashlight beam then picked up a standing, silent, robot-like figure, and then another, and then still others. The two young men returned to their tent and built up their campfire after they discovered that the light of their flashlight, when held on one of the robot-like figures, immobilized it. A kind of psychological siege followed, with the creatures approaching and withdrawing, corning as close as 15 feet to the terrified campers. The men stood, hatchets in hand, behind a barricade of upturned picnic tables and benches. One of them later described his feelings to me this way: "You know, you're petrified, you're too scared to run. I felt that I was going to die there, that's what I really felt like, and I had to defend myself." When the figures withdrew for a moment or so, the two campers made a dash for their car. The motor started and then suddenly died for no apparent reason. Its owner is a devoted car buff and he insists his vehicle was in top mechanical condition. It is at this point, I believe, that the two young men were abducted, though neither has yet agreed to undergo hypnosis. Our investigation establishes that there is roughly 1 hour missing from their account of that night's events. Other evidence supports this theory. 6. The point of all this is quite specific. About a week after their ordeal, one of the men noticed a small, round sore near his navel. Shortly thereafter, a second, and then a third appeared close to the first. Within a month long, straight, raised welts appeared running from these round sores downwards toward his groin in a converging pattern. Eventually, he entered a hospital for diagnosis. Though, he told no one about his experience in the woods. His companion also was marked, but by two diagonal cuts near the base of his spine. Three doctors attended him, a kidney specialist, a dermatologist, and his own family physician. A kidney tumor was suspected, but the tests for it were all negative. An exploratory operation was proposed and rejected. A week later, the young man left the hospital and the marks gradually faded away. Betty Hilricker 1 letter 7 that, during her abduction, a long needle was inserted in her navel. She was told that this painful operation was a pregnancy test. Barney Hill, meanwhile, lay helplessly on another table as one of the UFO crew members pressed a cup-like device to his groin. 8. Judy Kendall 9 felt that she was being catheterized. But these are just a few of the many abduction cases on record in which the medical operations involve the frequently painful use of a needle or other device in the groin or the lower abdominal region. I asked a genito, urinary specialist his opinion as to what may be surmised from this recurrent pattern, and his answer was succinct. If someone is interested in taking sperm and ova samples, it can be done this way, by going in through the abdominal wall. You can get both kinds of samples this way. My guess is that the raised welts on the fellow from the camping trip indicate that a foreign object of some kind, like a hollow needle, made a channel under the skin that later became irritated and inflamed, and possibly infected. The straight lines and their convergence toward the groin would support this idea. Like many other abductees, both male and female, Betty Andreessen recalled that a long, thin instrument of some kind was inserted in her navel. Under hypnosis, this dialogue ensued: :10 Q, did they tell you what the purpose was for the penetration of your navel? What was the examination for? BA, something about creation, but they said there were some parts missing. Q. Can you explain to us what was meant? BA. It was because I had a hysterectomy, I guess. In a somewhat related account, a Wyoming man named Carl Higdon 11 was abducted on October 24, 1974, while on a hunting trip. At one point, he was told to stand behind a glassy screen of some kind for 3 or 4 minutes, where he was apparently scrutinized. Immediately afterwards, he was told that he was not what they needed, and a short time later he was returned to his parked camper. 12 Higdon, in fact, is sterile, having had a vasectomy. These incidents support the unsettling theory that extraterrestrials need something from humans, possibly a certain kind of genetic structure, so presumably they must check through a large number of people to find what they want. Diversity. He kept talking about diversity, which he was very interested in, about how important biological diversity is. Virginia Horton's recollection of her captor's words further underlines the point, and leads to another startling possibility. It was as though they had a puzzle that they were working on and it was important to them. We need a little bitty piece of you, Ito, take a little, teeny piece of you home. Philip Osborne's memory of his childhood cut, I see a sort of a representation of just being opened up very cleanly and something taken out and then just put right back together. Virginia Horton's second episode, 10 years after the first, it was as though they had finished a research project. They wanted to share it with me because, this research used their visit with me, my contribution had been really helpful for them. It was something more than abstract research. A central difference for Virginia during this second abduction was the presence of someone, like a younger person, more like my age. It had the feeling of being more like a contemporary, and it was a female feeling, like a friend. There was sort of a female friend on the ship. It seems like she was a relative that got to come along and meet me. Virginia said the female's covering was lighter, more cream occult, and that she felt like a younger person. Like a bounder quality, more bubbly. I didn't think she was really my age, she was still a schoolgirl or whatever. Blonde, clean, complexioned, 16-year-old Virginia obviously identified with this creamy, bouncy near, contemporary who appeared fully formed aboard the UFO 10 years after a deep layer of cells was removed from Virginia's leg. The obvious and disturbing connection between these circumstances had gone through my mind as I sat observing the hypnotic session in Drive Claymore's office on that May afternoon in 1979. As Virginia relived the experience, however, it seems to me that she, herself, had not grasped its implication. Can an advanced technology, whose home base is outside Earth, be experimenting, Luther Burbank, fashion, with various human genetic combinations? Our own present day science has successfully mated sperm and ovum in a test tube, implanted the fertilized egg in a female body, and brought the fetus to term. Cloning is a much talked about area of current experimentation, moving slowly from lower animal forms towards man himself. There is no way to estimate what a radically advanced technology might be capable of, though Virginia's experience suggests an answer. Having speculated thus far, I must now reiterate my discomfort with the act of theorizing itself, particularly in the context of the UFO phenomenon. I deliberately refrained from extensive speculation earlier on, in the hope that the reader will also concentrate, as I have, on data and not theory. The data, however, does suggest certain conditions that any theory must take into account, particularly, as I have said, the decades long period of UFO activity and the large number of individuals who have been taken for the 1 or 2 hours these procedures seem to require. The theory of alien experimentation with human genetic structures satisfies these conditions. In some UFO abductions, the Virginia Horton and Betty Hill cases are examples. Extended telepathic conversations have taken place between the abductors and their captives. Occasional messages and even warnings, often pertaining to our misuse of the environment, have been reported. In a few other abduction cases, captives have somehow been shown cryptic, perhaps holographic images, again often bearing on ecological themes. The Betty Andreessen affair, as detailed by Raymond Fowler in his book of the same title, offers a particularly vivid example of these images. I have refrained from discussing in depth this highly ambiguous aspect of some abduction reports for a simple reason. Of the 7 abduction cases which make up the core of this book, and which I have investigated myself, only Virginia Horton's abductions involve this kind of extended conversation and display of cryptic imagery. The telepathic communications involved in the 5 abductions apparently consisted only of minimal physical orders, words intended to calm the abductee, and warnings not to remember the encounter. Throughout my own study of the UFO abduction phenomenon, I have tried, in the recently hoary phrase, to separate the signal from the noise. When one examines all 7 of these abductions, and then adds the many other cases to which I have alluded, one finds that every experience has its quasi-medical aspect, which often remains visible in the form of scar tissue. The inference is inescapable that these medical operations are part of the signal, while the occasional extended conversation may well be only part of the noise. Simple logic requires us to search for the clearest, most specific patterns we can find within the sometimes misleading mass of UFO reports. The physical operations are, indeed, central to If the UFO phenomenon has been so active for such a long period of time, how, one might ask, has it managed to escape the attention of various world governments and intelligence networks? The answer is simple but not immediately obvious.